This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everyone. Hello, hello. So, I'm Michelle Hetherington. I'm a senior curator at the National Museum in the Australian Society and History Unit. Can you hear me? Ah, very good. Thank you. I would like to welcome you all here tonight and to the latest in our series of Defining Moments panels, this time themed around the role of women, the role women have played and continue to play in defining Australian culture and identity. I would like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet tonight, and to pay respect to their elders, both past and present. I would also like to welcome and extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in attendance tonight. So I would also like to acknowledge our partners, who are ABC Radio National's Big Ideas program and journalist Paul Barclay, and the Canberra Writers Festival. Now, as many of you will know, this series of panels with Radio National's Big Ideas program is part of the National Museum's headline Defining Moments in Australian History project. For tonight's panel, we're delighted to also partner with Canberra Writers Festival and include among our panellists some eminent writers and thinkers who will bring their own unique perspective to the role women play in Australian society. A little background. Through Defining Moments, the museum wants to engage the public in a wide-ranging discussion about Australian culture and identity and the events and developments that have shaped it historically and continue to shape it today. Through this debate, we see that Australian history is not simple or one-sided, but a complex, nuanced and debatable narrative that we should all have a say in. And indeed, where we go from here is as intriguing as where we are right now. I can't wait to hear the views of our panellists tonight on all these issues. Unfortunately, Nikki Gemmell couldn't make it tonight, and we're delighted to welcome Julia Baird, who has kindly stepped in. I'll now hand over to our host, ABC journalist Paul Barclay, to formally introduce our panel and start the proceedings.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm Paul Barclay from ABC Radio National's Big Ideas program. Terrific to be here at the National Museum of Australia. Women make up over 50% of the Australian population, but you wouldn't know it if you just perused the history books. Tonight's discussion aims to rectify this. RN and the National Museum, in conjunction with the Canberra Writers' Festival, are shining a light on some of the defining moments and trends in Australian history involving and affecting women. In 1894, South Australia became the first place in the world to extend equal political rights to women. In 1943, the first women were elected to the Australian Parliament. In 1961, the pill arrived, giving women control over their fertility. In 1970, Germaine Greer's Female Eunuch was published. Women were granted equal pay in 1972, although that hasn't quite worked out as expected. And sexual discrimination was outlawed by federal laws in 1984. Look, these are just a handful of defining moments, randomly selected. Others, like, say, the influx of women into the workforce, which changed society, defy a specific date. We're going to discuss some moments and movements that mattered for women. Viewing them from the vantage point of the present, we have a brilliant panel of guests to help us do it. On my immediate left is Michelle Arrow, Associate Professor of Modern History at Macquarie University. She is author of Friday on Our Minds, Popular Culture in Australia Since 1945, amongst other publications. Next to Michelle, we have Jane Carrow, author, novelist, journalist, broadcaster, columnist, advertising writer and social commentator. No wonder you're exhausted, Jane, with a CV like that. And next to Jane, we have Julia Baird, broadcaster, journalist, columnist and political commentator. Her latest book, which is fabulous, by the way, and which is for sale later, is called Victoria, the Queen She has a PhD in history, by the way, like Michelle does. And on the end of the panel here, we have Shireen Morris, lawyer, constitutional reform fellow at the Cape York Institute and researcher at Monash University. Will you please make our panel welcome? Michelle, there's a kind of canon of key moments in our history, and generally it involves men. You know, Federation, Captain Cook arriving in 1770, Gallipoli, the Snowy Hydra, we hear this all of the time. What changes, though, do you think, when we look at Australian history through the lens of women? Does our perspective change?
Well, I think it does. I think historically we've always had this idea that nation building, which is kind of what defining moments are, they're moments in nation building or in national change. We've always tended to think of that as men's, you know, nation building is men's business, if you like. And I guess one of the things that's interesting and part of what feminist historians were trying to do when they sort of mounted an assault on this kind of idea was to try and think about how does the frame look different if we look through it on a feminist lens? So the very famous feminist history of Australia called Creating a Nation, which was written a few years ago, I think it might be out of print now, but that book doesn't start with the First Fleet. It starts with an Indigenous woman giving birth on Sydney Harbour near where the Sydney Opera House is today. And kind of by doing that, I think it makes us rethink the idea of what are beginnings, what are defining moments, what might look different if we look through Australian history with a feminist lens or a women's lens, if you like.
And remind us of how old the country is and the fact that it, of course, existed well before we Europeans arrived.
Exactly.
Julia, Federation in 1901 is the moment, really, when the nation comes into being. But at that point, we are still very much tied to the mother country, and it was Queen Victoria who gave royal assent to our constitution in 1900. She's the subject of your current book. And although she's not an Australian, is she an important figure in our history, do you think?
Oh, that's interesting. And as you're pointing out earlier, she died just a few months after giving that assent, proving that signing Federation is indeed a risky business. I do think she's an important figure in the early part of a country in a way, actually, that we haven't really even understood. And there's, especially with Indigenous people who have always claimed a strong affinity with her, there's a lot of mythology surrounding Indigenous people and Victoria and the granting of land. But the fact that we had a woman signing the beginning of our country, which, and there's also an excellent and very strong argument that that's when Australia Day should be, on that day of Federation, that's another matter entirely, I think is really interesting because it puts pay to the suggestion that not only women were invisible but that they were entirely powerless. And one thing I've really tried to challenge is the suggestion that simply because she inherited power that she was just a vessel. And that was not the case at all. At a time when women had none, when they didn't have property rights, they didn't have rights to custody of their own children, they were completely robbed of any financial autonomy. Here was this woman who sought the crown, who claimed it, and who fought for even its peripheral powers. She demanded to be at the centre of what was going on politically. She sacked prime ministers, tried to prevent others from becoming prime minister. Most unsuccessfully, of course, with Gladstone. She directly corresponded with generals in the field. And I think some way that we haven't really grappled with that. It's as though she's this ephemeral, stout, stern figure that dots our streets instead of someone that was very much present in the psyche of those that were trying to bring the nation together.
I'm interested in the observation you make about Indigenous Australians feeling like they can relate to Queen Victoria. Can you tell us a bit more about that? Because this is something I'm shamefully unaware of, I must say.
Well, yes, and it's something that I've been meaning to dig into more too, because I was trying to find the journey of two Indigenous Australians that were brought over to visit Victoria. Now, her interest in her empire was also an interest in then what was termed to be exotic. And even though she was genuinely often concerned about the plight of people at the far ends of colonialism or at the at the sharp ends, I should say. Often when people were paraded before her, it blinded her to what was actually going on and to a lot of the excesses and the brutality of empire. But there's only a couple of historians who have looked into this, and I am actually not entirely sure how it worked mechanically, because to me it seems that there seems to be a very prevalent myth or understanding that somehow Victoria was offering protection in terms of any land, 150 years ago, in fact about 3 or 4 decades before Federation. But again, I'd need to dig more into it. But if you speak to a lot of Aboriginal elders, they will talk about Queen Victoria as a totem and as an emblem, and I'm interested in that.
Jane, one of the moments that made it onto the National Museum's initial list of the top 100 moments was the visit to Australia of Queen Elizabeth in 1954, the first time a reigning monarch had come to Australia. And that Queen Elizabeth shares the name of the first Queen Elizabeth, who I understand is a bit of an idol of yours. Is that right?
Well, I write young adult fiction about Queen Elizabeth, the first Elizabeth Tudor. Who I think is actually legitimately can be claimed as part of Australia's European history, because, of course, we didn't, as a known in the world outside of Australia itself, not then called Australia indeed, we weren't here, and that's basically where we came from. And Elizabeth I, I kind of adopted her as a young girl because I was desperately looking for female heroes. And there aren't any, or any that there are tend to come to a sticky end. If you think about it, Joan of Arc is the screaming example of that. And Elizabeth was remarkable because she ruled on her own. She refused to marry. She refused to have children. She was universally considered at the time and to some extent since, to have ruled well, which is extremely unusual. Women leaders are usually demonised. And she died in her own bed of old age. So that struck me as kind of, oh, thank God this one. And I devoured everything I could about her, and so I've ended up writing these novels arrogantly in her voice. The third one comes out next year, and then she... Just spoiler alert, she dies at the end, so it's the last one in the trilogy. And she, of course, was also at the beginning of empire. So the beginning of the great British naval legend, which started with Francis Drake and the exploration and all that kind of thing. And, of course, Walter Raleigh going into America and founding Virginia, which was, of course, named after her. Virgin Virginia, and this whole outreach of the British Navy that, of course, eventually led to Captain Cook. So you can see that she has some relevance to the forming of European Australia.
Okay, so let's juxtapose the monarchy to Indigenous Australia, Shireen. We spoke in May here at the National Museum about the 67 referendum being a defining moment in Australian history, so we won't dwell on it again, but it was a woman who was at the centre of that movement, Faith Bandler, a woman who's an important figure to you. And it just got us both thinking, really, about the idea, to what extent are we seeing women stepping up as Indigenous leaders in Australia today? Because this is an area that I think it's fair to say has been rather dominated by blokes.
Absolutely. So Faith Bandler was an extraordinary historic figure, really the face of the 1967 referendum campaign that was a decade-long struggle for Indigenous rights, really. And most people think that she was Aboriginal herself. She wasn't, strangely. She was a South Sea Islander who also had Scottish heritage. And I think one of the extraordinary things that we're seeing in the Indigenous rights constitutional recognition movement at the moment, you're right, it's traditionally an area that has been quite dominated by men. We've seen these extraordinary, powerful Aboriginal women stepping up. Professor Megan Davis, who is this UN human rights international guru from Queensland, Indigenous lady, running the dialogues alongside Pat Anderson, AO, who's a veteran of Indigenous rights advocacy, but also this year, for the first time ever, we have a female social justice commissioner in Indigenous affairs, June Oscar, which I think is integral because what it does is shifts the sort of Indigenous rights, equality, discrimination discourse, which is often centred on group rights, to a focus on the woman, the child, the vulnerable within the group, whose rights so often get overlooked. But Paul, I just wanted to respond to something Julia said, which I think is so true in the debate we're seeing at the moment about statues and Australian history and defining moments. You know, our defining moments are very male. They're usually hand-picked through a male lens, but they're also very white. It's also, you know, and I think that's what we're seeing at the moment in the backlash against Australia Day and the statues. And Julia, I think the reason they can't put it on the 1st of January is because then we'd lose a public holiday, you know. New Year's Day, what would happen? No, but...
There must be some way around that.
You would think so. Yeah, you would think so.
Double up.
But the interesting thing is that history was more complex than that. It wasn't just evil and good.
Of course.
You know, as you say, there was... The honour of the crown was a real thing. And when Arthur Phillip sailed his ships to Australia, he carried secret instructions from the British king, instructing him to treat the natives with amity and kindness. So that, you know, there is this other side to those statues and those symbols. There were good intentions, even though those good intentions weren't followed through with. And I think... we need to rebalance that history and tell the good with the bad.
Yeah, and of course, sorry, if I can just add that, you know, when we talk about women in history, we are, of course, very fundamentally redefining what history is, which has been part of a project of the Academy for, you know, at least the past five decades. But nonetheless, it's completely wrapped up in statues and civic monuments and even the notion of what a defining moment is.
Yeah.
Like the entire framework is about volume and visibility and public activity. And if you're going to be a prime minister, if you're going to be a judge or a general, you've got a lot of odds in your favour. You know, like it took a long time to get the statue of Harriet Tubman up in, you know, at the end of Central Park, which is entirely, just to flip to the US for a moment, in which it's entirely empty of any female historical figures. Except for Alice in Wonderland. So you have to be fictional, yes.
It's like the Order of Australia. You know, the Australia Day Honours. There's still this very small percentage of women who even get recognised. And while you were talking, I was thinking about women who so quickly get forgotten, like Bobby Sykes, you know, who was such a pivotal... Indigenous activist and writer and, you know, and yet I haven't heard her name for such a long time. And I think that a lot of women disappear.
And I think part of that too, I mean, when you think about Faith Bandler, for example, you know, she was this face of sort of female respectability. She was the kind of pearls and handbag kind of, you know, vote yes, and it kind of made it almost irresistible to vote any other way. And a few years later, you have the Indigenous, the Tent Embassy, and the leadership of Indigenous movement in Australia becomes a lot more blokey, it's more young, so it's a kind of changing of the guard in generational terms. But I think, you know, it's fair enough to point out that there's an issue around sexism perhaps in the Indigenous rights movement too. So I think that, you know, that kind of transition of leaders and people like Bobby Sykes do kind of get overlooked
The events and moments that we're going to talk about actually are events that are the result of struggle as well, and that even when we talk about those defining moments, even after they occurred, there's still complaints from those who feel that their interests have been trodden on. Look, we are going to wander through a range of moments here, and I want to bring us to more contemporary times, to the middle of the 20th century. Michelle, the pill was introduced in 1961. I was curious, I don't know whether you can answer this, this is a question without notice, what effect did it have on fertility rates in Australia? And then as a follow-up, more broadly, what was the social impact of the introduction of the pill to Australia?
I'm not entirely sure what the impact on fertility rates were, but I know one of the kind of impacts on it was that the decline in babies available for adoption, for example. Mm. You know, that's one of the big changes that we see. You know, adoption becomes something much less common than it did when it was in the earlier part of the century. But certainly I think one of the big things about the pill, and this is where it's a really interesting defining moment, because it's actually a moment that happens in millions of households around Australia, because it's about giving women control over their fertility in a way that doesn't require male cooperation. So basically it's a contraceptive method that women can use, and they don't need to persuade anyone else that that's, you know, in their best interests. And so I think one of the things about the pill that is hugely significant is that it gives women the ability to control whether they have children, when they have children, how many children they're going to have, and then that gives them control over their lives. And we see more and more women entering higher education, more and more women entering the workforce in the wake of that ability to control your fertility.
It gives them control over their fertility actually at a time when some women were forced to have backyard abortions, actually. And it's worth mentioning, Jane, and I know you've followed this, that there is no federal law, there is no federal moment in Australia like Roe versus Wade giving women the right to choose to have an abortion. And I think it's always worth pointing this out, that two of the more popular states in the country still have abortion in their criminal code.
Both New South Wales and Queensland, abortion remains a crime. And I believe, well, certainly a young woman was prosecuted in 2010 in Queensland for procuring her own abortion.
And just recently in New South Wales as well.
That's right, yes. So, yes, people take it for granted that we have this right, but actually in New South Wales and Queensland we don't. And particularly in rural and remote areas, it can be very, very difficult for women to access safe abortion, even with the RU486 and all of that. And that's a pivotal, actually there's a defining moment. That vote in Parliament for RU486, when all the Conservative women and the Labor women joined together and actually got that approved, even with Tony Abbott, who was dead against it as Health Minister. And I think Amanda Vanstone said something very salty and terrific to Tony. I think she said to him, "Tony, this is not about you."
And that happened in New South Wales Parliament too. There's a number of occasions when there's been bipartisan support. Can I say Queen Victoria would have loved to take the pill? Well, without a doubt, she would have taken that pill. She would have taken it straight away when she was married. She was so depressed when she got pregnant so quickly. She had 9 pregnancies, carried them all to term. She only had chlorophyll for the last 2. She described it as a blessed relief. And this was in a climate in which clergy opposed it because this was women should suffer in childbirth because of original sin. And the doctors opposed it because they feared that women's libidos would be aroused and they would approach them, you know, inappropriately in the delivery room. As anyone who's ever given in birth knows, there's a temptation. So Victoria tried it and made it respectable. And the man who administered it to her, the first woman he gave it to, was so thrilled that she called her child anesthesia. And again, she was unable to form her official functions. She was worried that she'd have to stop. And as she said to the doctor, "Can I have no more fun in bed?" You know, Victoria, I don't know how many she would have had, but without a doubt, I think she would have employed whatever contraceptive methods were at her disposal. And she described to her daughter. Now, this is the domestic queen, that there was this icon of, like, you know, domestic joy, and she did love her husband in quite an obsessive way. But she described, she said, "When I see a woman walking down the aisle, it is like a lamb to the slaughter." And that, I'm convinced, is because of what happened to women's bodies and their sheer lack of control about what would have happened.
Exactly. Elizabeth I loathed all this marrying. She was really opposed to it. She hated her ladies getting married. She dealt with the whole dilemma of, because women died like flies in childbirth.
Oh, that's right.
In the period when Elizabeth was alive, as she saw a couple of her stepmothers die that way, all that kind of thing. And so I think when she had the opportunity to be able to say, "I don't have to," she decided not to, and that was really the only way that you could practically save your own life. She also, I think, realised that having a son would have meant curtains for her, because Mary Queen of Scots had a son, and then nobody was terribly interested in her after that, and we know how she turned out.
Did the pill also bring about the, as we've been told over the years, or facilitate the sexual revolution, or did everyone start bonking like crazy when all of a sudden...
Well, Jane's nodding.
Michelle, that's one for you.
I think it did for at least one member of the panel anyway.
But the only thing I'd say about that is that the two doctors, I do know this, the two doctors who are credited with inventing it, originally intended it to be used by married women.
It was for married women.
So they could space their families. And they were shocked when single women got hold of it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think for, you know, certainly women trying to get it in the early years, it was a little more difficult, if not impossible, to get if you weren't married. And I mean, I think, you know, some historians say, yes, the pill is the gateway to the sexual revolution. It's the thing that makes it possible. Other people say, well, the pill is a sign that something is changing in social and sexual mores around the pill. So I think it's one of those ongoing debates. But I think, you know, the kind of, you can, if you think about the world before and after the pill, it did certainly give women more freedom to be able to, you know, enjoy sex without worrying about getting pregnant necessarily, which is a huge, you know, it's a huge shift, I think.
The technological advances now, though, I mean, the way that the egg freezing technology, for example, has just opened up women's options in terms of career and when they think about having children, you know, have freed them up on this whole other layer where the biological clock is now less of a concern for educated professional women too.
Well, actually, your university, Shireen, Monash University, is at the forefront of what were called back in the early days, test tube babies. A lot of the research, critical research, was done at Monash.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah, indeed.
I was going to say, like, it was not that long ago that I realised that my young daughter actually, I had so many of my female friends having babies on their own that she actually thought that women spontaneously combusted. And I was like, how should I have this conversation with her? And she's like, no, Mum, I know. I think the man is sometimes he's involved and sometimes he's not. So anyway, it's a whole new different place to begin to talk.
It's a challenge for sex education, clearly.
It's the same thing with, we're watching, you know, the ABC You Can't Ask That, and it was about children of gay and lesbian parents, and
it's a terrific
it was
show,
all about
actually.
Donors. It's fantastic.
Really terrific show.
But that was an interesting one to have it with my little boy. Then we had to have the discussion, and he, when someone said, I've got an anonymous donor, and he went, oh, that's what I want, an enormous donut. we had to talk then. That began our sex talk.
A conversation for another day, perhaps. But I was going to add too, I think one of the things that's important to remember about something like the pill is that a lot of Indigenous women said, well, you know, we actually want to control our fertility, but we actually want to have more children. We want to keep our children. We don't want to be subjected to forced sterilisation. We don't want to be given long-term contraceptive implants and things like that. So I think on the one hand we go, yes, isn't this great? The pill does all these wonderful things for women, and I'm not saying that it didn't, but I think there's a flip side there that this cuts both ways, and it means different things, I think, around control of fertility for different
people. I'm going to move on to another issue, women getting the vote. I mentioned in the introduction that... that occurred in South Australia very early. Interestingly, the Commonwealth Franchise Act of 1912 gave men and women the vote in Australia upon the formation of the Federation, but it excluded Indigenous people who were included in the right to vote in South Australia. So it was an active act of actually, you know, excluding them from the vote. It wasn't until 1965, I read, when Queensland amended their laws, 1965, that Aboriginal people could vote in all elections in Australia. It seems, Shireen, like we kind of went, like from 1894, and then finally resolving this in 1965. We kind of went backwards for a long time, didn't we?
Yeah, it's extraordinary when you think about it how comparatively early women got voting rights, or white women at least. And then in certain jurisdictions in Australia, Queensland, WA, and at certain times the Northern Territory, not only Indigenous Australians actually, but non-white nationals from other countries as well were specifically denied the vote. And this bizarre case happened in around 1924, where an Indian man, a I think, an Indian national, but a British subject, challenged his exclusion under the Commonwealth Franchise Act, under Section 41 of the Constitution, and he went to court and said, you know, because the state law lets me vote, so this Commonwealth law is invalid under the Constitution. So the government freaked out, you know, changed the Act to allow Indian people the right to vote. Indian people only, not Indigenous people. Wow. Oh, no, incredible.
That is incredible.
So Indian nationals got the right to vote in Australia at the Commonwealth level decades before Indigenous Australians.
So what were they planning to just go through kind of nationality by nationality, were they, individual pieces of legislation? That
only
is bizarre, isn't it?
Only when people kicked up a fuss, you know. And I often thought to myself, gosh, if only that litigant had gone to court and made the general argument, you know, on behalf of his Indigenous counterparts as well.
Yeah,
I mean, changed history.
It's also striking that when we talk about defining moments for women, often we're talking about just conferring upon them basic rights that should have existed from the beginning. And, you know, I mean, I was thinking about this with the anti-discrimination laws. The Sex Discrimination Act came into being in 1984. I mean, that is kind of, you know, well within our living memory, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was in some ways a little bit of unfinished business left over from the Whitlam period. You know, Whitlam passes the Racial Discrimination Act in, I think, 75, and of course they're gone by the end of 1975. I think there were moves around, you know, around women's rights under the Whitlam period, which kind of get left behind, and then, you know, Hawke takes them back up again. And so, yeah, Susan Ryan is instrumental to the passage of the Sex Discrimination Act in 84, but it's, yeah, it's late, you know.
Well, actually, what is interesting, I'm going to go to America again quickly, is that when the Civil Rights Act in America was passed, and I think LBJ around about 1964, women were included in that literally as a joke. So the conversation, yes, I've just been doing this research and I've read this incredible story where in the Congress they were passing the Civil Rights Act, which was about not discriminating on the basis of race, religion, country of origin, that sort of thing. But sex wasn't there. And a segregationist who was trying to shoot the bill down, got up and laughing his head off to this all-male Congress apart from 12 female members in 1964, said, well, why can't we add sex to it? And all of them roared with laughter, thought this was hilarious, and as a joke passed it. One of the women Congress members got up and said, well, if there was any doubt that women are the second sex, the laughter and hilarity that has just ensued confirms it.
Oh, God.
So literally as a joke in 1964.
Yeah. Mm.
But then, of course, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment in the US didn't get through either, and partly from campaigns from conservative women. So, yeah.
But I think it's interesting because you talk about how the Racial Discrimination Act was kind of the predecessor and then the Sex Discrimination Act came. It's almost like the Sex Discrimination Act has become much more embedded. And I always marvel at the fact that 18C, the clause outlawing racial vilification, comes under attack for offensive speech and prohibiting offensive speech as a sort of an unfair hindrance on free speech. But the equivalent provisions in the Sex Discrimination Act that also outlaw offence and humiliation and things like that, using very similar language, nobody ever mentions it.
But is it because of so few people actually use it? I mean,
I don't know what the reason is.
Of the epithets hurled at Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister.
I mean, I wonder what would have happened had Andrew Bolt got in trouble under, for example, the Sex Discrimination Act rather than the Racial Discrimination Act. Perhaps it would have been a different story. So you may be right, but I think it's interesting that racist speech seems to still be up for grabs in the free speech debate, but sexually discriminatory speech seems to be off limits. And I think although we've got further to go in the gender equality struggle, I think that shows that it's done very well. It's become part of the accepted norm, in a sense. Would you agree with that?
I think if you think about the way that women are treated online, I suspect that, you know, there's a lot of disgusting, you know, well, sexist hate speech that gets thrown around online. But I guess partly because those acts are complaint-based, then maybe there's, you know, I think women talk about their own remedies to deal with it. I mean, Julia
maybe
and Jane probably have more sense of how that
it's
works.
Almost it's normalised,
life.
I think.
Yeah. I think it's
especially
normalized.
The way we... For a woman to have an opinion and have a position that's in any way public now... involves a degree of hatred that is astonishing. You need to have a secure house. You need to have the security for your children wrapped up. You need to be psychologically fortified against it. Your employers need to be aware of it. And people say this is just part of the workforce now. You just have to suck it up. It's just trolling. It's just online.
Yeah.
It is feral. It is destructive. We seem unable to stop it. And without a doubt, it is impacting who speaks in public life and how often and if ever. I mean, I sometimes have people who will not come on my show because they'll just get trolled. And just last week, I had a historian on. She hadn't been on the drum before. I thought, fantastic, expert voice, that'd be great. Mm. And it's the next day, she contacts me and says, how do you do it?
Yeah.
I couldn't sleep last night. These things were said and this person attacked me and it's...
It's the very question I put to Clem Ford recently when I was talking to her. How do you do it? How do you cope with the abuse that you cop? I think this is moving us into the arena that I wanted to talk about of women in politics and in public life and, of course, they cop it. Before we come to the kind of contemporary moment, though, Michelle, the first two women were elected to the Australian Parliament in 1943. Enid Lyons was elected to the House of Reps and Dorothy Tangney was elected to represent WA. Enid Lyons would go on to become the first minister, cabinet minister, who was female. And Dorothy Tangney, who people may not have heard of, she had an enormously long career in the Senate. She was the longest serving senator at one stage. Both of them remarkable women, and there is, I have to say, the most fantastic photo on the museum's website. You should check it out, of both of them entering the front doors of the old Parliament House together on the 24th of September 1943. Isn't that a wonderful shot of the
fantastic.
Two of them?
Where they would get inside and discover there were no women's toilets that they could use because, you know, the building
right
was... not so well. Not well, no women's toilets in the members area, you know. So, I mean, I think one of the interesting things about Australian political history is that we're one of the first countries to give white women the vote, but yet the lag between women getting the right to vote and the right to stand for election, that was, again, an early victory, if you like, for women's rights. The lag between actually winning that right and actually electing a female MP to Parliament is one of the longest in the world. So it's kind of, I don't quite know why. I think it's probably still very long deep-seated ideas about women's place and, you know, a lot of the arguments that women used when they were campaigning for the vote is that, you know, women have specific needs that only women can represent and all of that kind of, those arguments around women have a special contribution to make to political life. But, it's a sort of fantastic image, but it took a really long time. And I think, interestingly, that it happened during World War II when there were so many changes happening in women's lives.
I know Jane wants to come in. Before you do, Jane, I just wanted to... You talked about the fact that they arrived in Parliament House and found there were no toilets that they could use. Interestingly, when they built the new Parliament House, I'm told the first thing that they knocked off due to budget cuts was the childcare centre.
That was what I was about to say about the New South Wales Parliament.
Yeah.
Currently, where there was a fuss recently because they wanted to extend the women's toilets, and a few of the male members objected, which is quite extraordinary, because I do happen to know that one of the female members of the New South Wales House, Jo Halen, has had a baby, and the only place she could breastfeed her baby was in the ladies' toilet, and they put a chair in there where every time anyone came in, the door banged into her as she tried to breastfeed. This is now. So the fact that those two women went in and there was no toilets, it's still like that.
Mm. I love the thing about Enid Lyons as well, which is so remarkable, is how many children she had. Mm. You can have a dozen children go into federal parliament when actually after following her example, and she was so talented.
She
was
incredible.
A remarkable orator, and I think far better in oratory than her husband. And her speech writing and delivery capabilities were fantastic. She was incredibly efficient. And she was very well loved, and she was an excellent, you know, representative of Tasmania, I think, as well. But since then, it's been extremely difficult for women to get into the upper echelons. And we've had many cabinets at first devoid of women, and certainly devoid of mothers. And I think that's been a really interesting subsequent struggle.
Well, Julie Bishop, who is an overachiever in her pre-political life and in her political life, you know, someone who has... You know, regardless of your political stance, you know, she's done exceptionally well professionally. Mm. She made the statement not long ago that women can't have it all. And she was kind of referring to her own, I think,
position. I know, it's just that they're always asked this.
They
you know,
are
like
always
the men
this.
Are not asked that question. It drives me crazy. You're absolutely right.
It's a good point, and it's a point about the narrative around women in politics.
Can we define having it all?
Yeah.
Because having it all just means... having interesting and meaningful work and a family, which is what men take for goddamn granted they're going to have.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's the way we divide the issue of caring up, isn't it? It's still so incredibly gendered. But, Julie, you've written a book kind of about how the media frames women in politics. So I'm kind of interested in... how the narratives are different in how we present women and men in politics.
The book was about, was really up until the period. It was up through the 90s. So it was the first few decades of really Australian political life. And it all came to fruition in Julia Gillard. It was... Look, the heart of what I found was, and I went through all of the media files of every woman elected to Parliament in Australia. They're fat and thick and dusty and sit in usually the bowels of Parliament houses around the nation, unpleasant an image as that may be now I say it. But I found that really the problem at the heart of it is a cultural inability or to understand or a discomfort with the idea of women exercising power or exercising authority, so that when they do, it is seen as somehow surprising. Oh, housewife superstar. Not housewife superstar. Sorry. The Iron Lady, the steel butterfly, the steel magnolia, the iron fist in the velvet glove. What an extraordinary contradiction, and how bizarre and peculiar. You know, she wears high heels. You watch how many profiles of female politicians describe their high heels walking down the
Remember
Parliament.
When Julia fell out of hers in India and the fuss?
Who hasn't? So it's surprising. Or it's secondary. It's some way derived from the men around her, from the men in the cabinet, the men she's related to in Queen Victoria's in case. It's her prime ministers and it's her husband. Or it's severe and it's unpleasant. It's kind of excessive. It's somehow a savage and bizarre thing. And I think the flip side of that is the fact that we expect women to be more moral and above the political fray. And so a mistake is far worse and far more egregious. I think... They're judged more severely for it. And that, again, is often the problem with analysis of gender in politics. Mm. It is not that these women are faultless. It is not that they are perfect individuals. It is just that their sins are regarded as far more egregious. It's the volume and the protracted nature of the criticism, I think, is far more extensive. And because we've always thought of them as interlopers in a male world, it is assumed that their position in Parliament is far more precarious. Mm. And if we're going to talk defining moments, I think that Julia Gillard's misogyny piece, his speech, was one of the greatest moments in Australian political history.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not.
It was the most electrifying thing to hear, and we all heard it and all understood. The press gallery didn't. To this day, that perplexes me. I do not understand how they missed that story. All of the main newspapers the next day, it was all about the slipper. It was all about the speaker imbroglio. They missed the significance of her words to a generation of women. I instantly put on my shoes and went for like a 6-kilometre run. I didn't know where to put that energy. It was so extraordinary, and she was so particularly speaking on behalf of any woman who'd been slighted or diminished or silenced or put down, and then at that moment to have misogyny used against her. It wasn't like a dog whistle, you know, it was like a bitch blast. It was like a massive noise that we all heard and we understood. I'm not calling her a bitch. I'm saying that the female dogs, the women who were listening to that, understood it.
And that's why it went viral, wasn't it? Because it just went all, you know, social media was
globally
where
it went viral.
Went, you know.
Do you think, Shireen, do you think that's right, that the misogyny speech, do you see that as a moment?
It was an incredible moment. But for her as a politician, I mean, I remember thinking to myself, that is the first time I've seen her personality really shine through, and it seemed like she broke through of the constraints of this image we have of women. You know, as you say, that we somehow view the feminine person as being antithetical to power and ambition. And if you're an ambitious and if you're a woman who seizes power, then you're some kind of Lady Macbeth character with milk for gall or whatever, the, you know, that you're unfeminine and you're cold. But Gillard, you know, after she wasn't Prime Minister anymore, she talked about the incredible abuse. And she talked about getting rape threats, and she sort of warned aspiring female politicians to be prepared for that, which I thought was pretty extraordinary to say that that's part and parcel. But in terms of the childbearing and family balancing issue, she sort of made the point that you just can't win. If you don't have kids, then it's sort of like you're disconnected, you're not part of the real women out there.
Deliberately barren, I think, was the phrase used.
Yes, that's right.
And if you do have kids, well, then who's looking after them? Yes. And how are you going to balance all of these competing... But exactly, Jane, this is what every man does.
I kind of wonder, too. Yeah. I mean, politics has become so toxic in the last 10 years or so, and, you know, the esteem in which we hold politicians has fallen so dramatically that I wonder whether... the fact that she was our first female Prime Minister, whether the historical import of that has been lost. We were talking to a bunch of millennials here at the last Defining Moments conversation we had, and it was just interesting to hear one of them say, when I asked her, you know, like, what would you pick as your kind of handful of moments, you know, and she said, well, look, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, the election of the first woman as Prime Minister of this country has got to be seen as a tremendously significant moment. Yet I wonder, given everything that she went through, do we see it that way?
No, I actually think that, I think unfortunately that's deliberate, because I think that while we all resonated and rose up and went for 6 kilometre runs and were inspired by the misogyny speech, I think unfortunately there are another group of people in our society for whom it merely confirmed their prejudices about her being shrill and strident. The same thing as Hillary Clinton talking just in the last couple of days about, should I have turned around and told him to back off, you creep, when Donald Trump... I think what she did was right, but it doesn't matter what you do. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I think that the message that was being sent by a lot of conservatives right across Australia, whether it was conscious or unconscious, and in some it was conscious, some not so much, was to every woman and girl, don't you dare aspire to lead, because we will eviscerate you if you do. There was a purpose behind that bullying, just as there was a purpose behind the bullying of Hillary Clinton, that is to actually keep women in their place. We do ourselves a disservice if we don't recognise that.
It's impossible to pinpoint the kind of exact moment when the second wave of feminism hit the public conversation, but perhaps it was around about the time of Germaine Greer's Female Eunuch being published in 1970. I think it's a convenient kind of marker. How do we all assess the importance of that book? I think, like a lot of books, I suspect its impact far exceeded those who read the actual book. But, I mean, is that a big cultural moment, Michelle?
Well, I think a lot of men probably had it thrown at them, or, you know, in anger and frustration, you know, so I think there's that. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, because social movements are very hard to distill down to moments like that. You know, what would you pick out as the defining moment of second wave feminism? But I think something like Germaine Greer, you know, this kind of glorious, you know, she was so iconoclastic, she was, you know... took no prisoners. She was had that real kind of larrikin element to her, I think. She was a global celebrity. She really was that kind of famous. She was probably the famous feminist, I think, in that period.
She was charismatic too, wasn't she? Enormously charismatic,
you know. And sexy. You know, I mean, she was on the cover of Life magazine as the saucy feminist that even men like. You know, that was her kind of claim to claim to fame there. So, yeah, I mean, I think that what that as a moment tells us is that something was changing, you know, and then that book kind of resonates and plays out in a sort of ripple effect over lots of different lives. You know, in terms of Australia, you know, she wasn't necessarily part of the movement in Australia as much. She kind of came out here a few times and was always well received when she got here. But I think that she's a really important feminist celebrity. She tells us something about the social change that's going on in that movement.
Mm. And the 70s really was the decade when feminism kind of made it to the lounge rooms of middle Australia in a way, wasn't it? And I suppose that book played some role in that.
Oh, it was huge. I mean, I remember reading it. I suppose I was a teenager at the time, and what an impact it had on me was quite extraordinary. The only other book I remember having a similar impact a few years later was The Women's Room. If anyone remembers that book, that had a similar kind of here between the eyes thing. But there is a seminal moment, I think, around that time, which is when Whitlam made university education free, because the number of women, because I went to university at that time, and unfortunately my mother came to university with me because she had done, you know, mature age matric, and because it was free, she got the opportunity. And a lot of women went to university in 74, 75, 76, 77 because they got the chance because it was free and they'd been prevented when they were younger. And I think we haven't given credit to what a change that has made to Australian society, to the workforce, and to women getting into positions of power, that ability to get a degree.
Mm. Okay, we're getting to that stage in the discussion where I'm having to rush through events. In 1915, Shireen, the New South Wales government got the unfettered power to remove Indigenous children from their mothers and families, a bleak defining moment and one we've been dealing with ever since. Do you think that, that's over 100 years ago now, do you think the intergenerational trauma kind of remains for Indigenous people, and the fact that, you know, we now have still a generation of kids who don't know who their mother or grandmother was, for example?
I think that the trauma goes on, and I think the interesting thing about the apology was that, you know, yes, it was a win, but it was a symbolic win, and it wasn't accompanied with the practical action or the just compensation that it should have been. And I do think that's a lesson for the current debate in constitutional recognition and even, in a sense, the debate about tearing down of statues and changing dates and so on. But I think the extraordinary thing there is that, and I'm not totally sure of the statistic, but I think more Indigenous children are being removed today than were back then.
Mm.
And that is not often noted, and I think that is testament to the fact that despite the billions and billions of dollars spent in the name of Indigenous Australians, we are not succeeding. This area of policy is broken. The system is not working to produce good results. And, you know, until we get deadly serious about structural reform of the kind that the Uluru Statement called for, structural empowerment, serious empowerment, to ensure that Indigenous, not only women, but families and communities can take charge of these issues for themselves and have real input in policy making. I just think we will never crack this as a country. And that will forever be our shame, I think, if we don't get serious about that now.
Mm. In 2015, Rosie Batty was named the Australian of the Year. We all know her story and are astonished at her courage at deciding to become a figurehead to promote greater discussion and awareness around domestic violence. Jane, do you think this is a defining moment in terms of turning the public conversation around on family violence?
Yes, and I think there's been a number of those kinds of turning points in terms of the way we speak about things that we never spoke about openly before. And I think domestic violence is a really important one. I also think that sexual assault we're talking about in a much more open and direct way than we ever have. I've just put together a collection of stories of women talking about domestic violence but also sexual assault, stories they've never told anyone before, and suddenly we're in a safe enough place where women feel they can do that, and that's really important. I also think, however, we're starting to notice things for the first time. We're starting to notice how many poor old women there are in our society, how many women are living under fear of losing the roof over their head as they age. And I suspect this isn't new. I'm sure in your research into the Victorian era, the workhouses were full of old women. But we are now starting to actually look and be concerned for the first time. All these things, sexual assault, domestic violence, poverty in old age for women, are, you know, gone on for God knows how long. But for the first time, we're starting to look at it.
Julia, you've done some work on this recently, on the attitude of the church to domestic violence. Women, I'm told, from having read one of your articles, actually, on the ABC website, are being told to endure violence in the name of God. Have I quoted you correctly there?
That's right. I've been working on this for the past year, but it's been looking at religion and domestic violence. When you dig into the work that has been done, and there really hasn't been that much, she was like a powder keg, Rosie Keddie, that year. It was fantastic. The discussions were unbelievable. The sobering, the gradual realisation about the prevalence, and also the tolerance, even the term domestic, they were just having a domestic, and kind of around the criminality, the pervasiveness, the different forms that this took was all really crucial. There's a couple of different times they've looked into it. The Royal Commission, as a result, into family violence in Victoria. Also, Quentin Bryce's task force in Queensland. Both of them had a disturbing finding that was overlooked, which is that women in faith communities have very particular challenges. They're more likely to represent it to talk about it to their leaders, and the leaders are often ill-equipped and advise them to stay. We found that in Islam when we looked at that first of all, during which there is considerable confusion in some quarters about the interpretation of the Quran. Absolutely the mainstream view of scholars being that it's not acceptable, but the fringe, extremist elements. And that imams overall did not understand domestic violence and were telling them to stay. When we looked at the Christian community, still half of the country, we found that women were much more likely to stay in violent and abusive relationships, much more likely to blame themselves. And some of the good things about the church, being told to forgive, being told that marriage is important and that you must stick at it and you must endure, were in some ways making them vulnerable. That some of the teachings around, say, the doctrine of headship, where a woman is to submit to a man, and a husband is to lead his wife as Christ led the church in a sacrificial and loving way, but that this was being twisted by abusers to tell women to submit and to be obedient. Women literally telling me they would come home from a sermon and have these bits ripped out and thrown at them and saying, "You must obey." It was actually quite shocking, especially in terms of sexual abuse, financial control, emotional abuse. That seemed to me to be significant, and a lack of urgency amongst many of the hierarchy. What then devolved, as we reported on it, it became a question about statistics and about prevalence, of which there are none that are significant in Australia. And it was fascinating to see that defensive response, when I think we have to recognise culturally it is everywhere, it takes different forms, and we have to hear from as many women who survived as possible so we understand that the challenges and we understand their vulnerabilities and we can protect them better.
Yeah, very much so. One of the things we haven't spoken about is the, once again, a hard, impossible moment to put a time on, but the profound social change that was brought about by women entering the workforce at about the middle of last century and then, continuing participation rates. We had that moment where they were granted equal pay in, I think, 1972, as I said, we know that there is still a, was it a 17% wage gap. I mean, what reflection, Michelle, would you like to make on that fact about how society has changed and shifted with women becoming more active participants in the workforce, but basically becoming more active participants in society generally? I mean, is there something hopeful that we can take from this, that in spite of all the miserable stuff we've been talking about tonight, you know, domestic violence and so on, that, you know, women are clearly so much more a part of the sort of social discourse and society generally today than they were 100 years ago?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think things are changing slowly. I mean, we know that there are still problems in relation to things like superannuation, and that's going to be something that is going to flow through and have a very long tail of really discriminatory treatment, because men and women don't have the same amount of superannuation, and women still do bear that financial burden of taking time out of the workforce to care for children and all of those things. But I think that there is something a little bit more, you know, I mean, things like childcare. I mean, childcare used to be seen as, well, it's your problem, you have to sort that out yourself. And, you know, the idea now that there is an expectation that, you know, childcare will be not necessarily always provided by the state, but that there is some kind of financial assistance around childcare and things like that. I think that's huge. I mean, I think my working life looks very different to my mother's, and it's unrecognisable from my grandmother's. So I think there have been changes, obviously keeping in mind that, you know, there is still unequal pay. We still have a very, you know, sex-segregated workforce, although it's a little bit not as, you know, it's not as extreme as it used to be. So I don't know. What do you think, Jane?
Look, I think things have improved vastly in some areas. The very fact that we're paying attention and that we're listening to women's voices in a way we never have before, and their stories and taking them seriously, matters. On the childcare thing, though, I have a daughter with a 16-month-old who's having to pay more for childcare than her actual return to work salary would be. So that is a systemic disincentive for women to return to work, which in the long run ends up with them being poor when they're old. So we have this nasty, vicious cycle which traps women.
It's neoliberalism.
Yes, it's neoliberalism. Neoliberal model. It is the neoliberal model does not work out well for women. So I think those kinds of things, we still have lots to fight for. But in a funny way, what a wonderful thing to have something bigger than yourself to fight for. And it is, I hate this word, but I can't think of another one, it is empowering. And I think I have been so delighted by the charging back onto the world stage of feminism since the internet and the unmediated access to the public conversation that women and other groups that aren't white men have also been able to get hold of. And that is starting to change everything.
Okay, I really need to wind up the discussion, but being a sport fan, I can't leave it without talking about sport, because let's face it, some of the defining moments in Australian sporting history have been around women. Cathy Freeman winning the 400 metres at the Sydney Olympic Games, Shireen, I mean, I could talk about that event for the rest of my life and still not stop getting the tingles up in the back of my spine.
What an amazing moment. I mean, for a woman, an Aboriginal woman, and just she looked like some kind of alien superhero charging around in that amazing.
She was totally dressed for the occasion, wasn't she?
You know, and then after that she wore... carried with pride the two flags, which in itself started a whole national conversation that we needed to have, that needed to be started. So what an amazing moment. And, you know, PE at school used to be the bane of my life. And I think I harboured some dreams of going out to run only to have an asthma attack. But, yeah.
I think the grace with which she carried the nation's expectations in that moment. I mean, remember the moment at the opening ceremony where she's lighting the cauldron and she looked like she was going to be, you know, set on fire by that thing that she was, you know, riding in between. But I just think that moment, it really did bring the nation together in a way that I think was sort of seemed historically perfect, which I think was why it was such a special occasion.
Yeah, we can't forget how visceral that was. I just remember walking through Martin Place, walking through the city. For the couple of days beforehand, everyone felt sick.
Yes.
People were clustered around those and people were distracted and couldn't sleep.
What if she doesn't win?
It was like we were carrying that in our bones. Yeah. You know, there was something so remarkable.
Yeah.
about how we were running with her.
Yeah. Mm. There was something very special about Sydney, actually, during that time. The great Australian songwriter Don Walker of Cold Chisel fame wrote a song inspired by Sydney during the Olympic Games called The Way You Look Tonight, which is that double entendre about a beautiful woman and a beautiful city. And he said there was just that time when, after Cathy Freeman had won the Olympic Games and everything just seemed right in the world and this beautiful harbour city, a wonderful, wonderful moment in history. So that is 200 years of history crammed into an hour. Not comprehensively, but certainly a lot of fun. Look, thanks for coming along today. It's been a great conversation. Please put your hands together for our fantastic panel of guests. I think there are book signings occurring for those people who have books pretty immediately, so I do apologise for the absence of a Q&A session. I know that that was conspicuous, but the authors tell me that you might be able to sneak in a question or two of them when you buy their book from them. So there you go. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.